recall how it actually happened, but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before. And over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for K2 Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program, which was pre-recorded in the K2 studio earlier today. David Newton was my guest, and we spoke about Iraq, its history dating back to the creation of the modern-day nation we've come to know all too well for the wrong reasons, to the sectarian violence that's erupted in recent weeks and threatens to obliterate the country's 100-year-old borders. Before I introduce David, let me describe the current situation. The battle between the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and the Iraqi government continue to threaten and to engulf the entire region and redraw the borders of Iraq, Syria, and possibly more. President Obama has already authorized sending 750 non-combat troops and drones. This week he'll be getting the final classified assessment of the Iraqi security forces prepared by U.S. military personnel. It contains no recommendations, but is expected to give the president a clear indication that the Iraqi security forces are not up to the task. According to a front-page story in today's New York Times, he'll be told that only about half of Iraq's operational units are capable enough for American commandos to advise them if the White House does decide to help. He'll be told that Iraqi forces have the ability to defend Baghdad, but not necessarily hold all of it, especially against a major attack. And he'll learn that many units are so deeply infiltrated by either Sunni extremist informants or Shiite personnel backed by Iran that any American assigned to advise Baghdad's forces could face risks to their safety. In Congress, 80 members have written to the president, led by Congresswoman Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California, and Congressman Scott Rigel, a Republican from Virginia. They've sent President Obama a letter calling on him to seek congressional approval before taking any military action in Iraq. Congressman Rigel says, "Engaging our military forces at this time when no direct threat to the United States exists and without prior congressional authorization would violate the separation of powers that is clearly delineated in the Constitution." Congresswoman Lee says, "Any military action and alternatives should be fully debated by Congress to give the American people a voice in matters of war and peace." That's where we are today, and now let me introduce David. He is an associate professor of history and the chair of social sciences of UAS Juneau, where he has taught U.S. history since 2002. He earned a Ph.D. at the University of Minnesota. His pursuit of understanding history has included research in such fields as developmental psychology, criminology, medicine, and the social construction of race and gender. More recently, he has written about the use of World War II analogies in contemporary political rhetoric regarding the Cold War historical memory and the war on terrorism. So welcome to the show, David.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So Iraq, 2003, America invaded Iraq. Most of us remember that. It wasn't that long ago. It's modern history now, modern U.S. history. You're a professor of U.S. history. But let's go back quite a ways. And we're going to be talking about the creation of the modern state of Iraq, the modern borders. And tell us how it began.
Well, it begins, as so many things do, with European efforts to sort of extend their you know, communications, transportation, trade networks in the 19th century. And in addition to carving up territory in Africa and other parts of the world, European powers, like particularly Britain and France, made inroads into the Ottoman Empire, which was eroding around the edges in places like North Africa, and had never really been terribly well secured in, say, the Arabian Peninsula and parts of the Persian Gulf. So as Europe made these strides as they saw it, modernizing parts of North Africa and the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire, made efforts of its own to kind of consolidate its power and to embark on modernization efforts of its own in competition with Europe. When the First World War came along, the Ottoman Empire was sort of searching about for some kind of alliance. They made gestures toward Great Britain. They made gestures toward Germany. And to make a very long story short, when the war came to the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire struck an alliance of convenience with Germany, not out of any particularly strong ideological or political connection. It just happened to be that Germany was willing to offer the Ottoman Empire support. It was not a particularly successful alliance, and in the end, the Ottoman Empire wound up on the losing end, along with Germany and the Central Powers. In the aftermath of that, Great Britain and France did their best to carve up the remnants of the Ottoman Empire in a way that would prove mutually advantageous. And among other things, Britain took possession under the League of Nations mandate of Palestine. They took possession of what are now nations like Iraq and Kuwait. The British and the French sort of installed forms of government that were familiar to them. They preferred monarchies. They didn't particularly care where the monarchs came from. So in a newly created kind of mandatory state like Iraq, they simply borrowed Arab princes, and in the case of Iraq, they took a fellow from the Hashemite dynasty, which is based in the Hejaz on the western part of the Arab Peninsula. They took this fellow Faisal. They tried to introduce him into Syria. That didn't work. The Syrians pushed him out, so they gave him the throne in Iraq. So he. This is a family that had no, ethnic or political or dynastic connection to Iraq. They just happened to be deserving of, as the British saw it, deserving of some kind of role in the post-Ottoman Middle East. And so, the British create and then do their best to maintain a monarchy for the next several decades. Predictably, the people of the newly cobbled together nation of Iraq preferred to have a greater say in how their society and politics and economy were run. And beginning in the mid to late 1930s, you have this long period of political instability that lasts decades up through the late 1950s and even into the 1960s. To make a very long story short, the monarchy survives until 1958, and then you have a secular coup that takes place, basically forces that were aligned with the Egyptian leader, Nasser. This kind of Nasserite government survives and fits and starts for about 10 years until the Ba'athist Party, which was anti-Nasserite, rises to power almost simultaneously in Syria and then in Iraq. And out of that Ba'athist coup, the successful coup, there's one in 1963 that lasts for a couple of months, but the real turning point is 1968 when the Ba'athist Party comes into power and they survive until 2003.
So that's Saddam Hussein's party. That was,
yes, yes.
And he followed... When did he come into power?
Well, it depends on how you sort of evaluate that. He doesn't formally rise to the presidency until 1979, but from say 1972, 1973 on, Saddam Hussein was the de facto rather than the de jure ruler of Iraq, the main political agent. But it's not until 1979 that he formally ascends to the role that Americans are familiar with. But he had been basically there's sort of intelligence chief, security fellow.
And during this time, the 60s, once the monarchy was ousted, obviously, and the Ba'athist Party comes to power, Britain no longer has much influence, even though it did at the beginning.
Right, yeah.
America's involvement is predominantly around oil, or is that fair to say?
Right. The U.S. role in Iraq is, until the 1970s, it's really kind of operating at the margins. The United States is not concerned with Iraq per se. The United States has deep interests in the Middle East. It has very vested interests in Palestine and then sort of Israel. It's very preoccupied with the situation in Lebanon in the 1950s. And by extension, it's concerned about Syria. These are in the 1950s. The Eisenhower administration intervened behind the scenes as well as overtly in Syria and Lebanon, as well as, of course, in Iran with the coup that takes place in 1953. So the United States has sort of deep interest, and of course the oil interest that the United States was primarily responsible for developing in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in that region. So Iraq matters, but not in a kind of central way. If you asked Americans in the 1950s and 1960s, like, what are the most important concerns in the Middle East, Iraq would be very far down on the list of priorities, certainly farther down than, say, Egypt or Israel or Iran and Saudi Arabia. But the Cold War plays a real central role in kind of stimulating American interests in Iraq. But the real turning point there is the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. Iran had been America's deputy in the Middle East from the 1950s onward, but especially after Vietnam. The Nixon administration decides that for practical and strategic reasons, the United States simply can't be everywhere on the planet. And so it looked for regional deputies and made enormous investments in the military and security infrastructure of Iran. Iran and Iraq have a very long-standing and not very pleasant history together as neighbors. And so to the degree that the United States was invested in Iran, Iraq looked for support elsewhere. It looked for support from the Soviet Union, which was a concern for the U.S. During the 1970s, as it was everywhere. The United States was eager to try and drive as many wedges between the Soviet Union and any nation that might sort of saddle up next to it. But in any case, once the Iranian Revolution takes place, then Iraq becomes a very different creature in the eyes of American foreign policy.
Well, let's go back to Iran for just a moment.
Sure.
The 53 coup you mentioned, that was directly related to oil interests.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, the Anglo-Iranian oil company, AOC, this distant ancestor of BP, had a very lucrative deal stretching back to the 1920s. They essentially got 90% of the oil revenues that came out of Iran. By the 1950s, other oil-producing states had 50% deals, basically, if you look at the Dutch or even other sort of British and French companies operating elsewhere in the world. So the Iranians quite understandably asked for a renegotiation of that deal, and when AOC refused, they nationalized their oil fields and and you know, so seized the machinery, so to speak, and began taking all of the profits. This didn't go so well with Great Britain, which enlisted the support of the United States in overthrowing the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, arguing quite implausibly that Mossadegh was either a communist himself or a weak leader whose government could easily fall prey to a communist takeover. And so, you know, the 1953 coup sort of comes out of that combination of economic and Cold War interests, the mingling of those two interests. And from that point on, the United States invested very heavily in the Pahlavi dynasty, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah.
So the Shah's overthrown, which President Obama was the first president, I believe, to acknowledge that America had involvement in that coup when he spoke in Cairo in 2009. But after the coup, or after the Iranian Revolution, I should say, America has got a different interest in Iraq. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. As a counterweight to the new Iranian government, which was, of course, actively hostile to the United States, not only for its support of the Shah over the years, but for a variety of other reasons. But that was the primary one. The thing about the coup in 1953 is that everybody in the Middle East knew that this was an operation that the United States and Great Britain had undertaken in tandem. It wasn't really a secret, and as well, the involvement of the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy government and Lyndon Johnson and everyone else, the various efforts to kind of manipulate and manage the various transitions that had gone on for governments like Syria and Iraq over the years. And none of this was a secret either. So for people who live in the Middle East, the idea that their governments were being, but it's one that everyone's aware of. Okay. Yeah, so for people who lived in the Middle East, the idea that the United States might be tinkering with their governments was not something that would have surprised anyone. For Americans, by contrast, all of this would have been news. And so when the Iranian Revolution happened in 1978 and 1979, and when the embassy was seized in Tehran, documents that very clearly laid out the role that the United States had played in the 1953 coup were pieced back together by the students who engineered the takeover of the embassy, and it was that was really the first moment that really America, ordinary Americans who paid attention to the news would have become familiar with the idea that the 53 coup was not a spontaneous uprising by disgruntled Iranians, that this was something that the United States and Great Britain had
You mean the 79 revolution wasn't?
The 53 coup. So when the 79 revolution happened, among the sort of disclosures from embassy documents that were seized along with the hostages themselves were details pertaining to the 53 coup. That was something that among many other consequences of the Iranian Revolution, that was one of the more interesting ones.
So now, 1980, after the Reagan comes to office, the Iranian hostage crisis ends. America has and has since then been, had a tremendous adversarial relationship with Iran, and Iraq's its neighbor. The war in Iraq, between Iraq and Iran, begin right about that time frame.
Yeah, September of 1980, September 22nd, 1980. As I mentioned earlier, Iran and Iraq had a sort of an awkward history, and remarkably enough, the borders between the two countries had never really been terribly well defined, and you had numerous areas in disputes, especially along the Shat El Arab waterway, which divides the two nations. Iran and Iraq had a deeply adversarial relationship over the years, not just because Iran was predominantly Shia and the Iraqi leadership, at least, was predominantly Sunni, but Iran had played a role going back to the 1950s in stirring up ethnic tension within Iraq, especially in the northern Iraq and the Kurdish population. You know, Iran had actively aided Kurdish rebels who had been struggling against the Iraqi government going back to the 1940s. That ended. That relationship between the Shah's government and the Kurdish rebels ended in 1975 with something called the Algiers Agreement. But Saddam Hussein was the de facto leader of Iraq at the time, was never particularly happy with the Algiers Agreement. And so when the Shah's government falls in 1979, Saddam Hussein was more or less shopping for a pretext to engage in some kind of action to take parts of southwestern Iran that he believed were properly within the domain of Iraq. So that war is it's a war of convenience for Saddam Hussein's government. And, you know, to that degree, it becomes something that the United States is interested in, you know, as a way to kind of manage as best they can this new situation in Iran, which they had virtually no control over. So, you know, looking for a way to kind of counterbalance any potential threat that Iran might pose to Gulf oil and states like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, who were in no position to defend themselves. Iraq became not so much a formal ally, but rather a partner born out of this convenient and, you know, mutually acknowledged need to contain the Iranian revolution.
Is proxy a proper word for that?
In a way. You know, I mean, the United States did a number of things. It provided intelligence assistance. It provided economic assistance, including these sort of wink and nod arrangements with dual use technology. So the United States was very carefully monitoring the flow of parts and supplies and technology that could be used for military applications. So again, it wasn't a formal alliance. That's sort of it's a sort of a convenient term, but it's a bit of an exaggeration, because the United States was not particularly enthusiastic about Saddam Hussein's government either. I mean, the best evidence of this is the deals that the Reagan administration made with the Iranian government in an effort to get hostages released in Lebanon. You know, providing missiles by way of Israel and other third parties to Iran. These were not happy disclosures when everything kind of came out into the open in 1986 and 1987 with the Iran-Contra crisis. Iraq was not particularly pleased to find out that the United States had been providing weapons to its adversary. So it's a very complicated situation that develops in the 1980s, and it's also playing out at the same time that the Soviet Union is moving into and engaging in a catastrophic war that it will ultimately lose in Afghanistan. So there's a lot going on. And again, I think to get back to this point I made earlier, the work that the United States did with Saddam Hussein's government really had so little to do with any particular interest that we had in Iraq. It had to do with these other sort of tertiary problems, like what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in Iran, the threats that Iran might pose to America's allies in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. It's interesting because, of course, out of that kind of tertiary relationship, you get this character, Saddam Hussein, who becomes, in the eyes of many Americans, this super extraordinary menace by the 1990s. But we really didn't care all that much about him and his government in particular. But we got something very, you know, very different out of that relationship than we had expected.
Well, the Iran-Iraq war ended in 88.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when George H.W. Bush comes into the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 years before Saddam invades Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
What happens during those 2 years? Did we, without the war, did we ignore Saddam? Did we ignore Iraq? Or did we maintain some sort of relationship that had grown out of the one that started in the 80s?
That's a good question. I don't have a particularly great answer to it. Certainly, there were things that Iraq did in the course of its war with Iran that the U.S. chose to ignore. Most, infamously, the chemical weapons attacks that were undertaken not only cross-border into Iran, but also attacks against the Kurds in the north, as well as Shia rebels in other parts of Iraq. So those were things that the United States chose not to make a big deal about, even though human rights organizations and other groups were quite exercised about the use of chemical weapons. So that was one of the things that the United States, the end of the Reagan years and the beginning of the first Bush government, chose not to make a big deal about. You know, we continued economic relations, continued supplying Iraq with you know, surplus grain and other sorts of things. So far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, his people had taken an enormous blow for 8 years, had basically absorbed the full force of Iran's military, and had successfully protected other Sunni peoples in the Persian Gulf and in Saudi Arabia, and the war wrecked what had been a very strong economy. The Iraqi economy in the 1970s was quite successful, and the war basically ruined it. So Saddam Hussein believed that his country was owed a debt that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait were unwilling to pay in the form of higher oil prices. And so failing to convince his neighbors to take steps that would have enhanced Iraq's revenue stream from oil, they decided to just seize as much property as they could. And the closest and the easiest property to seize was Kuwait, which had long been contested. Iraq had protested when Britain granted Kuwait independence in 1961. They believed that Kuwait should be absorbed into Iraq, and it wasn't. So this was a piece of territory that Iraqi leaders had eyed up for quite some time, and they thought quite stupidly in retrospect that no one would care if they took it. And so it begins.
Yeah, he got that one wrong. Let me back up a minute to the chemical weapons use.
Sure.
That becomes obviously a big concern in 2002, 2003, during the build-up to the invasion. Does this country know where he acquired those weapons that he used in the 80s?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I don't have a really great answer to it. The sort of precursors for the chemical weapons and biological weapons as well came from a variety of sources, West German, French. The United States even provided, so far as I'm aware, I'd really have to go back and look at this to be certain, but so far as I'm aware, some of the biological precursors were provided by the U.S., but I can't speak specifically to which of those agents might have been made available to Iraq, but this was part of the whole scenario that develops during the Iran-Iraq War. The United States, even though Iraq had not been a close partner in any sense, Iraq became a temporary partner, and the U.S. was willing to do whatever seemed expedient in order to make Iran's life miserable, and sort of overlooking the transfer of material that could be used to create some pretty horrific devices was just something the United States was willing to kind of let slide.
Let me take a moment just to remind our listeners that this is KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. You are listening to Peace Talk, a VFP-sponsored production. I'm Rich Moniak, and I have David Noon in the studio, and we're talking about the situation in Iraq. All right, so now we've got Saddam invading Kuwait. George Bush mobilizes the international community to throw him out. What happens? How quickly does that go, and what happens afterwards?
Well, it's pretty quick. The war as a whole is pretty much done within, 75 days or something like that. I mean, it's a pretty brief. There's a sort of 100-hour air campaign, and then I guess really we're talking more about 3 months from start to finish. But of course the legacy of that war is, among other things, Saddam Hussein remaining in power, largely because the first Bush administration recognized that what came after Saddam Hussein would be much less predictable. And, of course, the mandate from the United Nations did not include anything beyond evicting Iraq from Kuwait. So the notion of toppling a regime was for a variety of reasons just not something that was actively undertaken. On the other hand, there were sort of overtures made to Shia groups in the south to rise up, and of course those overtures were not backed up by much other than hope that they would succeed, which they didn't, and those folks were crushed about as ruthlessly as anyone familiar with Hussein's government would have predicted. And then, of course, in the aftermath of the war, you get the lingering sanctions, which had a sort of ongoing devastating effect on Iraq's economy, its infrastructure. Of course, the human toll was horrific as well. That's the most immediate kind of legacy of that war.
And of course, the during that period of time too, the UN had a resolution requiring inspections, and they required Saddam to dispose of all his chemical weapons, his biological weapons, and anything he might have had in terms of developing nuclear weapons.
Sure. Yeah. This is one of the great, I don't know whether to call it a tragedy or not, but Saddam Hussein made a what again in retrospect seems like a fairly poor choice, but one that has a rational basis to it. Try and convince his own people as well as his neighbors, having fought a war against Iran, he wasn't eager to expose any weaknesses to the Iranian leadership. But as a means of bluffing, it now appears that, in spite of the fact that his government was not capable of maintaining a weapons program of any real substance, he preferred to maintain the illusion that those programs were ongoing. We now know everything was pretty much destroyed fairly shortly after the war ends in the spring of 1991. The suspicion that he was maintaining something clandestine lingered and became, of course, the primary pretext for the 2003 war. The belief founded, we now know, in virtually no substantial evidence, that he had weapons programs that might pose a threat to his near neighbors or distant neighbors.
But weapon programs, that's different than maintaining old weapons that he had. He was
right.
He was supposed to destroy the weapons. He had a destroyed economy from the war, as you said, with Iran. He had an economy being destroyed through the sanctions. So you've got weapons that he's supposed to destroy that he had, and then there's this suspicion that he's got a program to develop new weapons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's the new weapons that seem to be the threat, with the suspicion that something was left behind. Is that right?
Yeah. It was a combination of things. The accusations that there were older weapons, which would have deteriorated had they existed so badly that they would have been virtually useless. And this was where the famous kind of forged documents that seem to indicate that Saddam Hussein was looking for uranium from Niger and elsewhere. You know, the belief that somehow his government might come into possession of nuclear, biological, or chemical material that might be weaponized. So all of those things, with the sort of flimsiest of threads, were patched together into a narrative about Iraq as a terrific threat that could pose an immediate danger to Americans on American soil. There's so many fantastic stories that were floated about. Iraq might have missiles or drone aircraft that could somehow reach American airspace, and of course it now looks so pathetic and tragic. Retrospect.
And really, before that, America is struck by 9/11.
Sure,
we go to war with Afghanistan. There was no indication in the early Bush administration of any interest in dealing with Iraq in any way. As far as I know, I believe in Dick Cheney's task force looking at energy task force looking at oil. They were proposing to ease the sanctions so American oil companies can get into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's lots of statements out there by the administration that Iraq was not a threat.
Yeah.
So 9/11 changes that.
Yeah. Yeah, it changes it. On the other hand, it kind of revives this old idea that I think we saw very much in the foreign policy of the 1950s, that the United States could re-engineer an entire region. You know, with the Eisenhower administration, and we see this a little bit with Kennedy as well, and afterwards, there was an enormous enthusiasm for covert activity, a belief that small-scale operations undertaken at a minimal amount of expense could reconfigure the political climate of the Middle East, and so. So you saw all of these efforts, and the coup in Iran in 1953 is only the most conspicuous of these. But you saw all of these efforts to use these covert activities to bring about political change, and of course they all came to naught. I mean, they all backfired either in the near term or in the long term. You know, the Iranian situation took decades to completely blow back on us. But there's a way in which I thinking about this historically, there's an almost there's kind of a shared enthusiasm, but on a much bigger and much more violent and overt scale in the aftermath of 9/11, whereas the Eisenhower administration believed that it could refashion the Middle East to its liking through the use of small-scale covert operations that would be cost-effective. The Bush administration undertakes, a variety of projects on a massive scale for everyone to see that are basically aimed at the same outcome. You know, we're gonna transform these governments. We're gonna produce kind of democratic kind of political cultures out of nothing. For a region that, as I mentioned earlier, is justifiably skeptical of American involvement over the decades, this plan doesn't, as we can see, it doesn't come to much good end.
And of course, that's not the plan that he brings to the American public looking for approval to go to war in Iraq.
Well, they had so many different rationales that were floated. I mean, there was the fear that Saddam Hussein's government might somehow link arms with an organization like Al-Qaeda and sponsor terrorist attacks against the United States. That was of course, the primary justification. But, of course, we get all of the other stuff along with it, the kind of humanitarian rhetoric, Saddam Hussein's government killed his own people, which, as I mentioned earlier, was not something that was of much concern to previous administrations.
The weapons of mass destruction?
But the chemical weapons attacks that the United States more or less ignored in the 1980s became in 2002, 2003, like a big selling point. Like, this is why we need to get rid of this guy, because he killed lots of his own people.
And we don't want it to be a mushroom cloud before we do something.
Right, right. So there's the kind of fear-based arguments, these sort of humanitarian, human rights-based arguments. But then, of course, the story that Americans always seem to love to hear is that we are going to be these sort of evangelists for democracy, and that we can replace a dictatorship of decades standing with a government that responds effectively to the wishes of its own people, kind of multi-party parliamentary kind of democracy that has clearly not worked out.
Some of those tended to, if I recall, tended to be more afterthought selling of the war.
Sure.
The fear that you've mentioned, the fear factor was the primary, the ties to Al Qaeda.
Yeah, you don't really
the
see
weapons
the,
of mass
the,
destruction.
Yeah, you don't see the arguments for democratic transformation occurring until pretty late in the game. It's really not until the couple months before the war that becomes part of the story.
And it becomes the main story when they find no weapons.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that becomes the fallback. Well, we didn't find any weapons yet, but look at the purple fingers as people are voting for the first time in 2005. Those kinds of moments, which now have been, I think, almost completely overshadowed by multiple rounds of ethnic violence and civil war. I mean, you're talking about a country that's really had, two rounds of civil war, since 2005, 2006, and we're in the midst of the latest of those. And, so democracy seems like sort of a great stretch at this point.
Well, and perhaps one of the more embarrassing moments for President Bush was the mission accomplished on the naval ship off the coast of California.
Sure.
In May 2003,
mm-hmm.
At that point, the war looked like it was over as quickly as Afghanistan, as quickly as the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
It all breaks down after that. In between the emergence of a resistance, we had the Niger, I believe Ambassador Wilson penned an op-ed in the New York Times that said he was the one that went there and proved it was a fake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no investigation to that. It's just dropped.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when we look at lessons learned, obviously there were no weapons. Obviously the intelligence either got it wrong, as the administration would say, or as the people who don't believe the administration would say, the intelligence was cooked.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do we do now? We have Dick Cheney, one of the architects of the war, calling for us to re-engage, calling for America to, in an op-ed in the Weekly Standard, which is not one that I regularly read. I don't think you do either, but he's got a three-page op-ed where he's saying, what we need is air power, assistance to them, training, and special forces
mm-hmm.
in there. And he wants to salvage what he believes was lost. But what strikes me is, as we're talking about history, is the things that he brings up in terms of, what happened and why we went to war. I can read a couple of these, and I'd like to get your thoughts. One we just talked about, he says that it's undisputed and confirmed by Iraqi government documents captured after the invasion that Saddam had deep, long-standing, far-reaching relationships with terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. There's no evidence to that.
There's so many sort of tendentious phrases in there, you know, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, I mean, as if Al-Qaeda were a coherent network that you can sort of define in terms of, like, its organization and territorial parameters. I mean, it's almost as – we saw this take place in Iraq. I mean, you have existing organizations that, in a sense, kind of become – sort of independent franchises of Al-Qaeda simply by declaring themselves to be Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has no, no kind of genealogical relationship to, you know, the Al-Qaeda that had, Osama bin Laden's organization. You know, they sort of call themselves that. So to claim that Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda and its affiliates doesn't really, it raises more questions than it actually answers. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, yes, indeed, Saddam Hussein's government was a sort of a ruthless operation that did have ties to terror over the years. But, without sort of diminishing the severity of those charges and the evidence to back them up, that's not unique. You know, governments all over the world, including ones that proclaim to be kind of functioning modern democracies, have ties to organizations that, by any, reasonable definition, are, sponsors of terror and agents of terror. So to say that Saddam Hussein's government had ties to terrorist organizations, it doesn't really answer the specific question of why those particular ties, if they exist, are sufficient reason to launch a war that had, so many unanswered questions from the beginning, so what its purpose was, how it was actually going to be sort of carried out, what the long-term kind of as a vision was going to be. So yeah, again, I think with any American war, you can find alternative histories. You can find alternative histories of the Vietnam War that will tell you that the U.S. could have won. Now you talk to most practicing historians and historians specifically of the Vietnam War, and you're going to get a consensus that there was nothing that the United States could have done. No amount of money, no length of commitment, no strategy, new or old, that it could have employed to bring about a different conclusion.
Short of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, not that would have done any good, but so I think I think what Cheney is doing here is. He's got an alternative history of the war that's obviously got a self-serving dimension to it, and he's going to continue promoting it. There are going to be people who continue to believe that narrative, and they're never going to go away. The best we can do is just sort of acknowledge that narrative exists and point to the overwhelming preponderance of evidence that narrative is not well grounded.
Yeah, that's if we can keep Americans focused on it. I mean, America's like any other country seems to have a short-term memory sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially in foreign matters.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's safe to say that whatever historical narrative Dick Cheney is putting forward is not going to be the one that makes its way into the textbooks.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's small comfort, but
we don't want it to do
offer.
That. We don't want it to make its way into the news on a regular basis to start something new.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, the other thing he's talking about, amongst the several other revisionist histories, is, in my opinion, is that he writes. He says that the Obama is spending a lot of time blaming Bush for the end of the war, the withdrawal of U.S. troops, which had U.S. troops remained. The breakdown that we're seeing now in Iraqi society, and it wouldn't be happening.
Yeah, that's just silly. I mean, you know, you had massive troop presence in the middle of the last decade when everything in Iraq was sort of descended into this kind of sectarian violence and civil war. So the idea that the United States could have somehow kept a cap on that just seems kind of preposterous given the levels of given the troop levels alone, right?
And didn't Bush sign the Status of Force Agreement that required a withdrawal?
Yeah.
And Obama tried to renegotiate it and was not able to.
Right, right. Yeah, and there were a variety of sticking points, including legal ones mostly, looking for guarantees that civilian contractors, State Department employees, military personnel would be immune from any criminal charges if they've been accused of a crime on Iraqi soil. So that was one of the big sticking points. The Bush administration negotiated it, and the Obama administration implemented it, and I'm not sure why that's so controversial now, but.
And of course, the other thing we got out of the war was a government aligned more with the Shiite government in Iran, which we didn't want. We wanted a secular government. Saddam happened to be more Sunni, but more secular in terms of administering the country, even though he repressed the Shiite majority. So those tensions that are going on right now are related to a Shiite majority suppressing the Sunni minority.
Yeah, and al-Maliki's history would not have given anyone a whole lot of comfort if they were expecting a different sort of outcome. This is someone who had been sentenced to death under Saddam Hussein's government. Comes back and. For years, he's been prime minister since 2006, and for almost from the beginning, accusations that he's been, that his government has been more favorable to the Shiite population than others, that the Sunni and Kurdish political parties have been marginalized. I mean, this is not old, or this is not new. News. I think the big takeaway is that the government that the Iraqis got was a government that has proven itself incapable of creating any kind of political and or ethnic unity. I'm not an expert on kind of Iraqi civil society, and I don't know if. I can't speak to the prospects of that sort of thing under different circumstances, but it's clear that what we were sort of told was going to be the outcome, a kind of multi-ethnic, politically pluralistic democracy, has been anything but. And so now we're looking at a very real possibility that it's going to be a fragmented nation,
Yeah, and one of the concerns of that is the people that don't, they get forgotten in the big history and in the military minds. What happens if the Kurdish and the Shiite and Sunnis end up with their own regions? Is there going to be a mass movement of people to get out of where they would be the minority to go to a place where they'll fit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean that's what happened, 5 years ago, or longer than that. I'm doing my math wrong here, but yeah, back in 2005, 2006, I mean, you had these great population transfers. Entire cities were kind of depopulated. I think that's obviously a pretty likely scenario.
Well, you're a historian, so I'm not going to ask you this, but what do you think we should do? But
that's the question historians hate. We're better at postmortem than diagnosis and prediction.
But we have to learn from history. That's what we're doing, and
sure.
we need to talk about it so that we can be well enough informed to take the next step in difficult situations like this.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's I guess one point that may just be worth making is that the way that we structure these conversations, you know, what should the United States do, is predicated on this kind of lingering fantasy that we have some kind of still some capacity to shape events in a way that's either favorable to our practical interests or in a way that is going to be sort of beneficial to everybody. And I think there comes a point when the pot has been spoiled to such a degree that there's no productive role that the United States can possibly play on its own. And I don't know if we've reached that point, but my pessimistic approach kind of I think leads me to think we might have, like, long ago. There just might be nothing we can do.
Well, is it ironic that we're talking, at least there's discussions of some sort going on with Iran to help us?
Yeah. Yeah, so it goes. to quote Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, one of these sort of, you know, with what's been happening in the last couple of months with this kind of Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or Iraq and Syria, ISIS. We conveniently enough we need Maliki's government, which does have friendlier relations with Iran, not as friendly as some Iraqi political leaders would have had, but we certainly need Iran's help as much as possible.
Yeah, I guess, you know, from my perspective, the I got to say that the one piece of history we need to learn maybe is to learn to admit we failed.
Sure.
You know, I think that we failed in 53. And let a failure live for 25 years, mm-hmm. 26 years, and failure upon failure just brings more failure.
Yeah, that's
or denial of failure anyway.
It's failure all the way down. Yeah. Yeah. There's not a lot of, you know, success stories that we can point to.
Yeah, I think the word fantasy that you used is appropriate for us having an answer.
Yeah.
To do something of course, I'm advocating that we don't get involved again. I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think it's military.
No, that certainly hasn't borne a lot of fruitful results so far.
Well, we're running out of time talking about this tragic story in Iraq, and we're going to have to wrap it up for tonight. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about it. It was enlightening for me. I hope it was for the audience out there, and hopefully... we won't have to get on the streets to prevent the United States from getting more deeply involved in another quagmire in Iraq.
Yeah, let's hope not.
And that concludes our show for this evening. I want to thank Jeff Brown for assisting me in producing the program, and I want to thank K2 for allowing us use of the airwaves. Have a good night.